some of well, now the discussion the other day, just kind of reminding me. I saw I get a package of all the doctors that are then having. And then that invite you spoke about is nowhere in sight.
Also coming. When meet the minister.
Christmas is also coming, eh?
No, when meet the minister this afternoon.
Okay.
Because she's the one that signs the letter.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll make a sign it in front of you.
Okay. All right, so we've got there's one other thing. I've had a request from the department to change the program a bit, which I don't usually do, but I think the request is a reasonable one, suggesting that instead of looking at yesterday's amendments next Wednesday and having the Rajisha input next Wednesday, that we actually deal with the performance indicators of DIA next Wednesday. That give them a bit of time before the strategic plan has to be tabled in Parliament to have a look at the strategic plan. So what we'll do next Wednesday then is deal with DIA's criteria they use for performance indicators. Okay? It's a bit of a complex thing. I don't think it's been done in Parliament before, so we're trying to find our way. But it's really to try and see what's behind the department's thinking about their strategic, the performance indicators they put in their strategic plan. You remember last year, at the end of the year, we expected to measure the performance indicators, but we never had a discussion what those performance indicators are and why they're there. So what we're trying to do now is, in the beginning of the year, trying to look why the performance and what they are there, and then at the end of the year, when we measure those, we have a better understanding of the department and why it's done. So that's what we're trying to do, is something new, and so we'll see how we go. So that'll be next Wednesday. We'll still have the Water Research Council on the Tuesday coming to brief us, and then the department. And then the week after that, when was the on the Tuesday or the Wednesday? Huh? 26th. So on the 26th, we'll then have, if the amendments are finished by then, we'll deal with the yesterday's amendments of NEMLA 2 and the input on waste tire streams and other waste streams, particularly the Rajita stuff that's been in the media and some, okay? So that'll be on the 26th. Please change the program. Let's send out an amended program to members, okay? All right. Does the committee agree with that? You happy? Those changes in the program? Probably going to work a little bit better, give them more time to look at those amendments, particularly the disaster amendments. Okay. All right, so today we've got two inputs. Firstly, there's a integrated coastal management amendment bill that's been introduced. I think it's still not certified, but I usually don't like the hearings before certification, not for any other reason that they may make a lot of technical changes, and then you sit with two bills, and people don't know what they're doing. So we won't send out press statement until we have the certified bill, but we'll at least take the briefing today, okay? So that's, and then after that, we'll take a short briefing on the green paper on oceans. As I said, I don't want a detailed briefing at this stage. When we do the public hearings later in the more or less probably the second term, then we'll take a more full briefing on oceans. At this stage, I just want to understand what the principles are in it. So those are the two things we'll deal with today. I hope it doesn't take too long so that we can let everyone adjourn. I know Maz Rikalala needs to go and have her hair done and eyebrow plucked. I need to have my person who puts my lipstick on is coming to tomorrow as well. Yeah, I'm going to look smart. Shaven, son. I haven't shaved for a while. So we all have to look smart tomorrow, so we're going to try and give time. But of course, we'll do the things properly. All right, let's, who is DJ? Who is going to present the bill?
Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members, Dr. Razina Omar and Advocate Radia Robert will take us through the Integrated Coastal Management System. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members and colleagues. Seeing that this is the first time that the Integrated Amendment, the Integrated Coastal Management Act and the Amendment Bill is coming to this committee, we're just going to provide a very brief overview, and then we are going to have a look at the amendments in terms of the following format. We'll discuss what the problem is, proposed solution, and proposed wording clause by clause. I will give the brief overview. Just in terms of background to the Act, the Integrated Coastal Management Act is a CIMA, and it was promulgated in a specific environmental management act.
Yeah. In other words, how much we know
okay.
We're only MPs.
It is a specific environmental management act focusing on the coast. And it was promulgated in February 2009 and became effective on 1 December 2009. All sections except for six, which largely was linked to the aspect of the public property and linked to grant rates, the members in the part of the committee then 3 years ago was remember that there were some issues around coastal public property and transmit and their assets. And so those six sections are not in operation as yet. And in that regard, we saw that the Seashore Act and the Docking at Sea Control Act still remains in operation until the amendments have been approved.
I'm not understanding. Just being told the amendments, what does that mean?
Okay, your question is...
Agnes was told, Agnes was told by you, so tell us what she was told.
Okay.
She told that it's in effect.
Okay.
It's
by law, okay.
Yes.
Some of the sections of the bill did not come into effect.
Yes.
Basically, we then had to enable negotiations between the department and public enterprises in respect of Transnet, and the provisions that we are amending now deal with those issues.
Oh.
So, and when Radia comes into the presentation, she will then explain what did we have in the previous what we have in the Act currently, which has not been made to come into effect. That's of the actual amendment.
So the parts haven't become into effect. The amendments you're making now will partly rectify.
We'll rectify that, and therefore, in the Seashore Act not any longer being applicable in the future.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DG. So, just very briefly, in terms of our overview, we can ask ourselves why we needed an Integrated Coastal Management Act. I think if you look at South Africa has a very large coastline. It's one of the top three in length in Africa. It's a large coastline of about 3,200 kilometers. And in line with global trends, where we have 40 to 60% of the population in a country migrating and living along the coast, approximately 50 kilometers from the coast, South Africa is no exception. So we have a densely populated area in the strip called the coast, which is the interface between land and sea. Now in the past, before the ICMS kicked in, and some practices are still existing, we had the past practices were characterized as poor decision-making because there was no legislative basis, and this poor decision-making had a devastating impact on the poor in particular, and resulted in particular decisions that risk the lives of people, property, and also the natural coastal environment, making us vulnerable to pollution, and also in terms of other aspects linked to the coastal environment, like fisheries, managing these ecosystems very poorly. So just in terms of a visual effect of bad right management practices. You can see that a local community, in the Western Cape, inundated with flooding, poor decision making, building on wetlands. The flood next to it is when we had a ground constructed bus to the high water mark, obviously not a sustainable practice, risking property and human lives. Also, what is very key is that we have coastal processes largely ignored. And these are naturally occurring processes, which include the amount of waves and current and sand. There you can see on the one side the effect of a storm on property, and also on the other side where the beach is now subjected to erosion due to bad planning. A continuation of malpractice in terms of terms, looking at a dual invading property, just ironically that is in an area called Versailles, and in Afrikaans it's the Versailles taking over the house, and in the property case we have that being, that property collapsing, and that beautiful city is being seen the end of its days because of development that occurred. Not taking into consideration the one is of the flood lines. Further aspects of the ASEAN Act is trying to address is to have pollution control. Look at the one slide at the bottom where you see blood water flowing onto the beach. That is from an aquaculture plant, and those practices are still occurring in some places. Stormwater pipes. And then we also have oil pollution. And what I said at the beginning of this issue is being very sensitive ecosystem, very important in terms of freshwater, important in terms of the economy of the country. You will see that estuaries are poorly managed. The rest is there in terms of the legend shows areas where estuaries are not managed well, and the total in size was the densely populated areas. For example, the metro, Nelson Mandela, Etiquini, Cape Town, and that's just an indication of what the ICM Act is trying to address. This year, for example, in terms of managing of estuaries, we have presented for public comment the National Estuarine Management Protocol, which is now going to come back, and it's on route to be formally presented. That will be a piece of legislation.
Why is it that we didn't get a copy? The National Estuarine Protocol.
It was actually made available to the committee a year ago.
Yes.
So we can make it available again.
I want to see evidence of it. I have never seen anything on an estuarine protocol.
Okay. We will definitely just.
It was never made available.
It was
not made available.
Okay, I will check.
I am clear about these things.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. What we will do is to make it available. It has come up for public comment.
Yeah, but so this is the point. I've raised with this department 300 times. When you guys send out something for public comment or it's available, then you write a letter to me.
Okay.
You address it. You attach the document. You send it to me.
Yes.
Or if the protocol is that you want Parliament to have it, then you send it to the Speaker.
Yes.
You guys will be careful to keep on saying you send this if you don't. Okay. I keep these things very carefully what I receive from you. And I keep a program much more detailed than any other deaf person.
I know.
I've got a whole list of things that we need to deal with on front of our program. Now, if I receive a document like that, I put it immediately onto that list that is part of it, and I check the list always that we're doing the work. So if it's not there, then I've not received it.
Well, Chair, I think in line with your decision or our discussion about all the regulations and standard procedures that we are developing as a department, we will make sure that we send you those with the government.
And the way that you can check is you go and check the program and see if it's written on the front there.
Okay.
They don't know that I've got it.
Okay, sure. We'll do that. Thank you.
Apologies for that oversight then, Chair. We'll make sure that it comes to the committee before it's final proceeding. So that in a nutshell gives us an idea as to management practices on the coast, what the ICMS tried to address in terms of creating past practices that were not sustainable. And that has now been in effect for 3 years, and during that process, during this implementation time frame, we discovered that there were certain changes required, and therefore hence the amendment bill, which is in front of the committee and change its name, which Advocate Rizak will take us through. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. May I proceed? Dr. Omar gave an overview of the Act and alluded to the reasons that we're amending. The nature of legislation, of course, is when implemented, you realize it's not as perfect as you anticipated when you initially drafted. So you'll find, what I'm going to do, Chair, is go through an overview of the amendment. I didn't think that today would be a clause-by-clause interrogation, although if you want it to be, we could proceed on that basis.
No, do it because we're still, after we've asked for public comment,
sure.
Then we'll see if there's a necessity to do something more detailed.
Okay, so what I've done is I'll give you an overview of the amendment as well as zone in on some of the key issues that you need to be aware of, the issues that create a bit more emotion and that tend to be a bit more controversial. There are a number of definitions are amended in order to clarify language. You again find when you implement a bill that you can always tighten up things, you can always make it a little bit clearer. We broaden certain terms, we've inserted definitions which previously omitted. They are predominantly uncontentious definitions, and you'll see this when we go through the clause by clause. A lot of them are just clarifying language or making certain stakeholders a bit more comfortable with terminology, etc. There are a few textual amendments or corrections due to errors during the parliamentary printing process. You'll see some obvious examples of this, and there are incorrect references, etc., that are also dealt with.
Sorry, are you suggesting the committee agreed to certain things that were wrongly printed?
I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that there was...
The committee agreed to amendments that were wrong.
No, they agreed to amendments that weren't correctly captured when they were typesetted. And between the state law and the UP, there's actually words that don't make sense in Section 59.
I'm trying to find out how this happened. There's two ways it can happen. It can happen that a mistake happens in the committee.
No, it did not. It did not, Chair. I can assure you. You'll see by the nature of it.
But that's impossible, because, I mean, any bill that gets printed, you depart and check afterwards.
But this is exactly what happened between the state law advisors, because it was between state law, and I'm not supporting blame. There may be blame on the part of the Department of State Law Advisors and Parliamentary Printers during that process, because somewhere along the line it wasn't proofread properly. It's unusual, it's not ideal, but it happened.
Wow.
It happened.
Has someone been sacked for this? I'm quite stunned, because I know the process of the Parliament, and I know that between the Mr. Bell and them, the department and the law advisors, they check these things and they proofread it. I'm just stunned that amongst that they missed the proofreading. DG? Wow. All right, we'll look at what they are, but
okay.
I must say, I want this to be brought to the attention of the committee section, and I want to check, not to lay blame anywhere, I just want to check how it happens, because I'm just like stuck. Just, where did it go wrong, so we can try and see, As I said, I don't want to report and blame. I just think it's, Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. You see some of the other types of amendments. It's quite a long goal, so I'm just going to give you a snapshot view. Just say there's certain issues that needed to be aligned with NEMA. Being a specific environmental management act, just to clarify, it is one of the specific environmental management acts under the umbrella of NEMA. So it has large NEMA frameworks to which it ascribes and then specifically deals with proposal issues. Therefore, alignment is essential. There were other powers, including delegation powers of MECs that were either clarified or extended. A very important concept here, and you'll see this permeating throughout the process of dealing with this bill, is clarifying the composition and ownership of what is known as coastal public property. This sounds a bit ominous at this point, but it will become clear when we deal with those specific sections. One of the things we needed to do was to ensure that we struck a balance between the environment and the mandates of other organs of state, such as Transnet, and to ensure that coastal public property does not impact on the ownership of their assets and operations within ports, for example. We've also clarified and expanded provisions.
Because we're not dealing with it point for point, those two bullets of yours there about the public property, explain to me more what that is.
Can you give me a chance, because I've got specific slides. Yes, okay. I've got them. I'm dealing with them later on in somewhat detail.
I have no problem.
Okay. We're also going to clarify and expand provisions on what is called reclamation. I'll also deal with that later on, so it will become more evident. Then there's simplification of administration of coastal access fee approvals, simplifying and amending powers relating to coastal leases and authorizations, another issue which will be explained later. The abolition of the National Coastal Committee, which will also be addressed. There are certain institutional arrangements that are created in the Act at all three spheres of government, and the national one has been replaced. We've also revised offences and penalties, and based on yesterday's discussions, I presume we'd probably have to tighten some of those up more in this committee. And we also provide for exemptions. All of these will become clear as the process unfolds. I'm looking specifically at key amendments to discuss within this briefing session the most important things that are going to emerge. Under definitions, there's just really two definitions that may bring some attention, and what I've done is I've done this issue by issue rather than clause by clause, because a lot of these things are dealt with in a number of sessions to address a problem, and it's easier to conceptualize and understand them if we do them that way. If you look at the definition of estuary, I thought it best to give you illustrations of what we're talking about, because these are highly technical concepts and sometimes it's very difficult to visualize it. So you need to understand what an estuary is in relation to the other areas that are managed or fall within the scope of this Act. An estuary is the intermediate between the sea and freshwater. So it's not really part of the sea, but it flows into the sea and is influenced by the sea and by the tide. So it has what is called a higher salinity level. It means that the salt content in estuaries are higher than it would be in a river. So what happens is when you've got the fresh water coming towards the sea, this section called an estuary is kind of smack in the middle, and then it's between the two, and it's your link. Now you can understand why this is an important area for us to manage properly, because it influences the sea and it has an interaction with the sea, which means that stuff that happens within that area will impact on your ocean or your sea environment. Now what you see there is a picture of Cape St. Francis. And this this area here, where they, I'm sorry, I need to get a point for which I will in a second, but the area where there's houses and canals, that area over there is a developed area. But what you see in there is actually a canal system, which consists of water that has been created artificially, but it leads into your estuary over there. So you've got the whole system where there's houses and there's the canal system that's in between these houses. You know, you probably know of many such developments. There's one at the V&A waterfront, for example. Some of them do and some of them don't exit into an estuary. This particular one does, and there's many of them that do. We had a problem, and this is what I'm addressing to you, is why they need for an amendment to estuary. We were finding different ways of trying to make this canal system from part of the definition of estuary, and you want to ask why. If somebody dumps something within this water system, it flows out into the sea. It affects that ecosystem, and it becomes a problem. So what you have to do is you have to manage it as part of the estuary and part of that ecosystem. So in order to do that, you need to make the definition clearly include that canal system. In the previous draft, and when we do the clause by clause, that will become more evident to you, we had a definition of watercourse that we've taken from the National Water Act to try and make that linkage. And then when we got public comments, a lot of people were very confused by that and saying it doesn't make sense to them. We need to make clear that the canal systems do form part of that. So what we do, and of course, there's the pollution control and also access in these channels, in these canals for the public or for the launching of canoes, etc., which also impact, and that would make a difference as to whether the canal system forms part of the estuary or not. And if it forms part of the estuary, remember it's in the act, it's regulated. If it doesn't, it's not. That's just putting it simply. We've then deleted the reference to water course, and we've refined the definition. We've tried to make it more technically sound and more legally sound. And when we do the interrogation of this wording, I've projected it so that you can get a snapshot view at this stage. When we start interrogating this definition, we can see whether we've in fact achieved that objective or not. You'll see that we've taken up water course. We've also added the aspects of salinity, the measurability of that was unclear, and we talk about salinity gradient between the tidal reach and the body of surface water. If needs be, we will get technical input into that when we deal with this definition. But that's what the wording looks like now.
I must say, when you look at this for later, on the face of it, having removed water course for whatever good reasons, when I just read through this, it doesn't make it clear to me that canal is now part of estuary. I would have imagined words added at the end here, including, and then you say whatever you want to say, any artificial da-da-da-da-da-da that's been created within the estuary or... You don't have to respond now. I'm just saying, on this, of what you explain now and what I've got here, seems to me having
an answer. And that's why it's going to be necessary for us to do this carefully, because we've considered all of those options. And there are difficulties in that not all artificially created water courses are going to form part of the estuary. So we have to exclude those that aren't. But the key term is permanently or periodically open to the sea. And you'll find that when there is a connection with an estuary, if it is periodically, permanently or periodically, and periodically is left open to the sea, that it automatically includes them. But we'll get back into the semantics of that chair.
I'm just saying, legally, I don't see how that works.
Okay,
I'll say you have to persuade me. But legally it doesn't. I mean, all this is it's permanently or periodically open. I understand that. That's an estuary. It's not a canal. But okay, we're not going to discuss it now. You're going to have a look at it and...
If you look at the salinity issue, if it's higher than fresh water and in that canal system, if it's automatically open to the sea, the salinity will be higher. And that's an easy test to do. So what I'm saying is
all what you add here, doesn't matter what else you add, unless it's clear that the canal is part of it. And yeah, I'm saying to you on this wording, it does not appear to me legally.
Okay. Sure.
Then the salinity doesn't help after that. Because
so there will still be ambiguity. But yeah. we'll be your open hands to amend that.
No, we'll do it later. Okay. Just thank you.
Chair, high watermark is another issue where... You will find that there are very many different opinions on what the definition of the high watermark should be. I need to alert you that we've had extensive internal stakeholder consultations with various specialist technical people, and the Survey General who plays a key part in the determination of a high watermark to come up with an appropriate definition. You'll see that, and I'll allude to some of the problems, and again, you're going to have to interrogate them when the time comes. Being a lawyer, I was advocating for a fixed line, and so were my other legal colleagues, and some other people were also advocating for a fixed line, and then we were convinced through the participation process that there are very many problems with actually having such a fixed line, because it's practically very expensive and very difficult to do that, and it is not accurate. Because the movement of the high water mark is dynamic. It will be at one point and in another at another point. And given the variable scientific and natural processes, this is exacerbated. What we had previously, in a previous definition, we had the 1 to 10 year flood line, and then we were told that it's extremely difficult to actually determine what is that 1 to 10 year bloodline, because you don't know where to start. And it creates more difficulties. And the scientists got together and they said, well, listen, under the CETL Act, we've been for very many years now working with the high watermark in its natural sense and with its and movement of its natural boundaries, and it has worked, there haven't been problems, and we should revert to that. So this is another definition we're going to have to look at closely.
Well, as it's written here, it's not really a definition because it's a factually established, so it actually means nothing.
And well, yes, Jay.
Because in the end of the day, you'll then have to factually establish what was the highest point, and you'll have to need evidence to be able to say where the highest point was. So this definition doesn't help you to establish it.
Yes.
So as you said, legally, unless you have some fixed line that you can pinpoint it, the definition doesn't help much. But if they're telling us that it hasn't caused any problems, I'd like to hear that when we deal with the bull property. So why it hasn't caused problems?
Yes.
It has caused problems for them. Munikravati Yaki.
These are just examples of, well, obviously you've seen the previous slides on poor development, etc. And where you've got a situation where a building was built and you're just on this particular little structure here, which is actually now going below the high water mark. Because you have situations you don't have that kind of legality around the high water mark, this can then happen and coastal erosion can cause your high water mark to move, and then you'll have these unsightly little things happening here, and you want to avoid that kind of thing.
My golf club is being starting to wash away. It's a very serious problem. At the moment, it's started taking the sand away. It's come quite close to the building, so I know what you're talking about. I live and see it every day of my life.
Well, Chandler,
you must find the right definition, please.
I think we might have quite a bit of work to do trying to get this, but we've been trying all along, and we're going to continue.
I think what you must do when we look at this definition is the way to really look at it properly for the committee, not now but then, is where they act, you need a definition. It's going to be important. So then we're going to see whether the definition doesn't create problems or not. Because you'll have to show us in Section 20 we need it for these purposes, in Section 10 we need it for these. And when we read those clauses, you'll then be able to see what definition you need. Because clearly this definition is there to facilitate the clauses. So I think when you prepare for this next time when we deal with it, make sure that we link very clearly those definitions to which part of the clauses so we can look at it together.
Yes, and
then see what the word is. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I've already started that process, but you'll see the next slide is really using the high water mark specifically.
Hmm.
It's clause 9 of the bill and in section 14. This is it's very closely linked to the definition because this section is also a problematic section that it deals with the movement of the high water mark and how it impacts on property. And of course, it's a very emotional issue because there's a lot of people, private property that gets impacted by this. And again, there was a lot of debates to and fro about what's the best way to deal with it. And we consulted the Survey General, who is generally responsible for the demarcation of these cadastral boundaries, etc. And you'll see that there were substantial changes done in that. Previously, there was a provision that allowed owners go and create beacon boundaries on their property, but what would happen is the seawater then you lose that anyway because it just starts eroding. So we have to look for a practical way to do this, and at the moment what we're sitting with is we have to work with nature, and if the sea accretes, in other words, if it increases the size of your property, you will gain, and if it takes away, then there's a loss of that ownership to the extent that the high water mark has eroded it. And we anticipate that there may be certain issues coming out around that, but that seemed to be the most practical way to deal with them. So and those are the issues you need to be aware of when you start going close by close with Section 14.
Well, the first thing that strikes me there is what you said. If you gain, you gain.
Yes.
So that you should put in the clause. Because then you say to them, it's not just taking away, it's gaining as well. It seems to be an obvious thing that if you're legally creating that, you say if you gain, you gain, but if you lose, you lose. You can't snooze.
Yes.
That's the first thing that strikes me there. That's a sweeter.
Chair, the next issue is really the crux of why we needed this amendment bill and why it was so difficult for us to actually come up with something. And I really, it's regrettable that you were not part of the previous process because you may have helped us to deal with it then. When this bill became an act during the parliamentary process, there was a lot of debate with Transnet about this area. And I think before I go to the problem, and of course I need to take you to this picture, we use this picture in Parliament. It's a very rudimentary sketch to describe the zones that make up this act. And I'll tell you why we need to go into this, because then you'll understand how coastal public property fits into this. When you look at this area between where the red line is, it doesn't really show me, where the red line is, that's the border of that red line is where total public property begins on the landward side. That blue line is the coastal zone. It's the entire sense of the scope of the act, but we're now concerned with this red line here. So it's going to be your beach, effectively your beach area, your sea, that interface, and what these little green spots here are the Admiralty Reserve, which we inherited, the Forestry Reserve that were declared as state-owned land and then managed as such. They've been included in coastal public property. Now, what this act has done is it's actually taken the Roman Dutch principle of res publica. In other words, the sea and the seabed is sacrosanct. It is an area that is not capable of private ownership. And it must be managed in a careful and responsible way. And what it's saying is that this that we call coastal public property belongs to the citizens of the country, but it is held in trust by the state. That's what Section 11 and 12 of the Act currently says. And of course, it's our responsibility as a state to manage that area, and that's what we're trying to do in this Act. Now, if you see, this area is a very busy area, including this area here, very, very busy area. Because you have, although we have 3,200 kilometers of coastline, amongst it is a whole lot of ports that exist within that area. So ports we know are high impact areas, and a lot of that we've foregone and said, okay, we're fine because we have to operate ports, we have to have ships coming in and up, and we have to have certain economic activities happening there because our country needs that, and we can't ignore the rest of the world. That's our gateway. And that's where we receive goods and services, etc. But we then came up with almost a conflict in the sense that we had to strike a balance between what happens in those ports and what we have to do to ensure that there's minimal damage to the environment. And as you may know, our EIA process is quite extensive. At the moment, they still have to conduct EIAs when they have to do development, etc. But what happened was, when we created coastal public property, there were other things, there were other laws that became incumbent in that area. And that's where the problem started. One of them was that we have this concept of coastal leases, which we inherited from the Seashore Act. So any activity that happens within the coastal, you see, under the Seashore Act, that area belonged to the state president. And the state president was the owner. There's just a shift in that it belongs to people, but the cabinet and the state and all the soft state. But they had the system where there were leases. If you want to do stuff on the seashore, you'd have to come to Parliament, which they still have to do under the Seashore Act, and ask for permission to lease that space. And that happens, for example, with aquaculture activities. And it happens with the Department of Environmental Affairs. Now, in the new Act, a new leasing regime was created. But that leasing regime was, and you'll see, was very extensive. It really said, the wording was so wide, it said, like, you can't do anything in that area without a lease or a concession. Now, that created certain practical problems. In other words, you had to put out an umbrella that was to be assessed to whether you needed a concession or lease, which is not practical. But more importantly, the Transnet thought that when they must operate in that water area, they were afraid. They were saying, listen, if you're taking that away, you are dispossessing us. They saying, we own ports. And if you dispossess us, we can't do our work. We can't get loans, we can't do this, we can't do that. Now, we had a definition. And that definition, we thought at the time, did exclude port assets. But it wasn't clear enough. So what we did was, under, as you know, pressure cooker legislation is hideous, so, because it comes back and it blows up in your face. At that point, we tried to find a semblance of a solution so that we don't impact on ports, because we have this ongoing discussion about whether it does or doesn't impact. Transnet then wanted us to exclude ports from the ICM Act, but we couldn't, and I want you to look at this picture. Because when you look at ports, it's not just the port footprint. It is the entire area. This here is Robben Island. In the Cape Town port, for example, there's an extended port area of almost 100 kilometers, which is in the National Ports Act. So it's not just the physical port area that they're operating, but it's that entire sea area and even parts of Robben Island that would then be included in that. And we were saying, well, look, that's not tenable, because we have to manage that area environmentally sustainably. We cannot exclude that from the Act, because it would just really be subverting our mandate and our responsibility in Parliament. I was not happy with that either. There was a medium a solution that was proposed, and that was that the port area, the footprint, just that area there, be then excluded from coastal public property with a coordinate. So what happened was, Parliament then made a very quick decision. They added a section into Section 27 of the Act that allowed for exclusion from coastal public property. Now you'll see, these diagrams here just depict the coordinates of exactly what, we took two examples, but the Cape Town port area and the Durban port area as examples to show you. But there's, of course, a whole lot of all the other ports in South Africa similarly were excluded, but just the port footprint. Subsequent to that, it emerged that that was not such a good idea for either Transnet or DIA. Because Transnet then found themselves in a position where once it's excluded, it becomes state property. It becomes state-owned land. And then for them to get ownership of that, they had to go through the State Land Disposal Act. And then for us, what happened was, we realized we subverted an important principle of not allowing ownership of the seabed and the sea itself, because that's not land. It's not registered in the deeds registry office. It is an area of operation. So for us it didn't work, and for them it didn't work. So we didn't commence the sections that dealt with leasing. We didn't commence the sections that dealt with the ownership. We still have the section dealing with the definition of coastal public property. But what we tried to do was get clarity on the whole thing to make it understandable and to make it make sense to everybody. We had to re-look at what was in and what was out of coastal public property. And we have then found ourselves in a position where we say we have to hold on to the principle that the sea and the seabed is not capable of private ownership, and I'll tell you why. If, for example, we allow it to be capable of private ownership, even if it is by a government entity, eventually, if there are no safeguards, and that land, that sea gets reclaimed, it gets developed, it gets sold off, we can bid for it, then sell off our coastline, which is really, we have a responsibility to ensure that that doesn't happen, because that's our mandate. So we don't want to open up the door to that. So we've now tried to define the definition, and again we're going to look to the portfolio committee to help us to see whether in fact we've achieved that objective. In the coastal public property, we excluded the assets that are in port. So in other words, the physical assets, the stuff that they rely on for them to get security on their loans. You will have a jetty that has already been established, for example, and they lease out these jetties, and they need security of tenure on those leases in order for them to get money to generate port development and their normal functions under the port act. So we don't want to compromise that. And we don't need to regulate that because it is already a dirty bear and it's already registered to them and they have wet assets and dry assets. Those things have been taken out of coastal public policy. But we still maintain that the sea and the seabed that within ports are still subject to the normal laws because they still have to get what are called dumping permits when they do dredging in the port. Because what happens is they have to move sand and sediment all the time in the port to excavate.
Because of those amendments at that time, do those amendments exclude NEMA?
No, they do not exclude NEMA, Chair, but they exclude the other safeguards.
They exclude like a dumping.
Yeah, well, they would exclude, you see, coastal public property is linked to NEMA now. Because there's activities that are listed for coastal public property. If you exclude those activities, if you exclude some coastal public properties, it misses that extra loop for EIA.
So it doesn't affect us as far as NEMA and EIA's are concerned.
It would.
But it does.
It does, Chair. Because if we exclude from coastal public property, there's an activity listed in NEMA for coastal public property. And what happens is in this act, the way it links to the NEMA EIA process is what Section 63. Section 63 adds in criteria that needs to be taken into account when you do EIA.
So with a new amendment, NEMA will now then come operational again for the port areas. And these other permits and so on, which would then have been excluded under that amendment, would now be included.
Yes.
So what that would mean then ultimately is as far as the sea is concerned, you guys will have control under the new definition. But as far as the hard assets are concerned, the immovable property and that, the jetties that exist,
mm-hmm.
if they want to build a new jetty, they'll have to do an EIA.
Yes, and a recommendation.
So what is there will give to them.
Correct.
In terms of the movables, immovables and so on.
Correct.
But that the sea part of it then will be back to us and totally be able to regulate it either in terms of NEMA or in terms of this, whatever this act is.
Correct.
So that's what you're trying to do.
That's exactly correct, Chair.
Well, it sounds right. Clearly previously it was a problem.
Yes.
We just should never have done it.
You will also see, Chair, that previous exclusion we try to reverse in this legislation. We set it to say we have a clause that reverses the exclusion made by Parliament. We sent it to the Sustainable Advisors. We sent it to them for preliminary certification. They haven't mentioned anything about it, but it may raise legal issues which we can clear up in.
Sorry, what exclusion?
Remember the port footprint that I showed you earlier. It went to Parliament because Parliament said, in terms of Section 27, we're going to allow you to exclude the limited port areas from coastal public property, which means we then exclude the sea and the seabed. They then went to Parliament and the House voted on that section which they inserted and said, okay, we agree we're going to exclude these. So that was done, that exclusion. But now, Transnet doesn't work for us actually now when we look back at it. We look back and we say it doesn't work for us either. So we have to...
So you mean what you mean by exclusion is the original clause?
No, the actual exclusion, the clause, we amend. The clause gives the power to exclude. The clause says, when you want to exclude for other than government purposes, you need to go to Parliament. And Parliament must make a decision as to whether you can exclude or not. And that was done.
So that was kept then, and you send it to the law advisor to keep it or remove it?
We want to remove that now. Because we want to undo what was done. We want to undo the...
Won't this other amendment undo what was done?
No, it won't because that exclusion was effected. There's some debate about the legality of that exclusion, but it's never been tested.
I understand what you want to do. What you want to do is you want to amend this clause to make sure that in a port, that the sea part of it will still now, that NEMA will apply to it, and that whatever permits and that are in this act will also apply to it, which is excluded under the other one. So that's quite clear to me, and that the immovable property would belong to them, they can do it. If they want to add anything to it, they'll have to ask permits and so on and so on.
Correct.
So I understand that. This exclusion thing was, I understand, a power that existed with Parliament, that they can, to that principle that we, if we amend that, that they can add exceptions to that rule.
Yes. And they did not decide on.
Now, why do you want to remove that? Why would you want to remove the power from Parliament that it's always had to be able, if you restored the better position?
No, we haven't yet checked.
No, but if you change the act and what it sounds right,
mm-hmm.
why would you also want to remove the further power to then create exceptions?
Okay, so because there is another section that allows for the adjustment of coastal public property for and against. This exclusion was specifically designed for Transnet. But if we allow exclusion of coastal public property as opposed to adjustment of boundaries, you are saying, we are then saying it's okay to make the sea and the seabed subject to private ownership.
You're not saying that, you're just giving Parliament,
yes.
not a minister or anyone, Parliament giving the power, if something is brought to Parliament mm-hmm. to say we want to create an exclusion in this instance, Parliament is open to the public, you consult on this
yes.
issue, and then you decide, yeah, we will create an exclusion.
Sure.
Look, you don't even need the exclusion really, but I just don't know why we want to remove it. Because in any case, if and something is brought to Parliament, in any case they'll do amend the act.
Yeah.
To you know, so Google cannot be
Okay,
Chair,
I'm quite happy to
if we make that amendment and this committee agrees and we restore all the things back to here
yeah.
as far as the coast and the sea and that is concerned. And there is a further clause that says that if, I don't know who they say is allowed to bring such an exception to Parliament, but to consider such an exception, I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be something we should take away from Parliament. I'm very jealous of Parliament and its role and so on. Because in the end of the day, what we're doing is if we're only leaving it at the hands of the department to be able to deal with things and so on, not that they can create exclusions, but if we're only leaving your hands, guys aren't always perfect. You know? Yes, Bob?
Maybe when we come again, we can then illustrate the volume of work that would be involved if Parliament had to do it. Because this doesn't involve only...
Then the talk further, but now you're talking nonsense. I come with volume of work to Parliament. I'm here in Parliament. I'm a public representative to work and do things. If there's a lot of work that has to be done, don't come with volume of work to Parliament. That's not nonsense.
Chair, it's not only the volume, but if I can illustrate an aquaculture farm or an aquaculture facility, in order to lease the system, all those applications would have to go to public. But we can, maybe when we come back, illustrate that so that we share them.
But you know what you're saying to me? You may, maybe there's going to be a lot of fun. You say to me, we wouldn't want Parliament to work and we wouldn't trust those politicians, but we, as a department, we make those decisions in terms of these policies.
No,
and we think that's fine.
No, you're saying.
Either you do it or we do it. Now you say you want to take it away from us because it's going to be too much work for us. And, you know, we as Parliament sleep all the time and so on. But what that would mean is that the power lies with you.
I think the context of that exclusion, such or Transnet, was more... a negotiated agreement between departments, I must say. Because
what exclusion did you grant Transnet?
No, this is about giving Transnet, they see this as honor in terms of their own business position. And the department...
The exclusion?
That's why they need the exclusion. They need the exclusion in order to be able to conduct what they call their normal business without onerous provisions that arise from the
idea. The exclusion is something that has to come to Parliament and to be granted. So it can't be part of their work.
Yes.
And what I've understood from the inputs today, if they agree and we agree that the previous amendment is a problem, not the exclusion, we'll come back to exclusion.
Yeah.
The previous amendment where the sea doesn't belong to DI anymore and to the people. Now, I understand from the amendment we want to now change that. and we take back the sea. So the sea is out. And we give them the fixed property. That's one issue, which sounds to me, which we should have done in the first place. Then to me, and I may be wrong, I don't know these things, I'm new with this, but what I'm hearing is that then there's another clause that creates the possibility of where this sea is now yours, dear, and the people. That there's another clause that will allow for exceptions or exclusions or whatever the word is you want to use to be created. For example, if you want to create a fish farm or whatever, that's what I understand.
Can talk about later. Here, when we say the problem statement is the history of Transnet in respect to their own business. They raised letters directly to Parliament at the time in terms of that clause. And they then made an appeal, which is why that clause...
Sorry, but geez, you're not helping me. What do they raise with Parliament?
Can you explain?
What kind of things are they raising directly with Parliament? I'm not understanding that.
There was a hearing that in the last process,
yes,
when the Act was going to be finalized in Parliament, where Transnet came to make a submission to Parliament, and the kind of solution that Advocate Radia and Razak was talking about were solutions that seemed not to have helped, which is why now there is then this reconsideration of those exclusions. So I think this is where she was trying to explain what then the content of the submission, and we then looked at whether then it can be done.
So am I misunderstanding then? Because then I must be misunderstanding. I've understood that Transnet has agreed to give back the sea. Not everything.
Yeah, what we agree that the ownership of the sea, yes, should still be with the president, or at least with the people.
And cabinet has agreed with it. That's why it's amended earlier.
Yes. But then cabinet also conceded to the needs or the requirements that Transnet has put forward, which is what I think Radia was trying to explain this exclusion.
Okay, I think there's two different issues. The one is, and you've captured that on coastal public property, but the clarification of what's in and out. Transnet does not agree with us on the way we approach it. They still want to be taken completely out.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter what Transnet thinks, because, I mean, it's cabinet has agreed, so the government has agreed. Parliament will now look at the matter, and if we agree, then it doesn't matter what Transnet thinks.
Okay, Chair. Now, the other issue is where it becomes confusing. Because remember, there's a principle of how we define total public property in the principle. But there's something else that happened during the parliamentary process. Well, when that clause was inserted, they actually did a physical exclusion at the time via Parliament of the port footprint. So that was effected prior to the bill being signed by the state president. The House voted on the basis of that exclusion clause in Section 27, that the port footprint would be excluded from coastal public property. That was Transnet and I.
How did Parliament vote on that? Is it a resolution? Is it a bill? Is it a...
It's a resolution, Chair.
Is it?
But we can obtain copies of that resolution.
Yeah, I mean, how do we not have it? Not.
We will bring that when we do the clause by clause interrogation, Chair.
But what are you saying then, that the footprints have already, through a decision of Parliament, have already been excluded?
Yes.
So you want to reverse that?
We want to reverse that. That is where Transnet and DR have the same.
What does Cabinet say?
Cabinet okay with that because they've okayed that clause.
They're okay with what?
The clause that purports to do that in this book.
To take it away?
Yes.
So Cabinet's agreed to take it away and give the seas back to GIA,
yes,
and therefore, by implication, they've agreed to overturn that. But now we need something in this legislation to physically say that that is going to change. What practically, I think the only thing we have to look at is what that practically means. As I mean, have they acted in terms of that decision of Parliament and certain things have happened, and that are not then part of the definition of immovable property? Because if it's part of the immovable property, then we've given effect to it already. We don't have to do anything further. See what I'm saying? If there's been a decision to the footprint is now also part of the transnet, so that part is there, and you're going to reverse it, the only detrimental effect on transnet can be is that they've acted in terms of that decision or policy. If they haven't, well, then there's no real, and all that we have to do is find a way of overturning that resolution as a passed by. So it may not have to be something in the legislation. It may be something of just overturning that resolution. So we'll have to look at the legalities of that and see what's the best way. Now I'm starting to slowly understand. So it's not an exclusion clause you're trying to remove. It is the effect of a decision of the consequences of such an exclusion that you have to deal with it. So they're coming different. Okay, so I now understand.
All right.
It takes a bit of time. I'm not quick. We are going to take a long time.
No, trust me, it took two years in Parliament for people to understand this at the time.
So I think you guys, when you come again,
yes,
you need to properly, and you must make this resolution, give it also to Tuleka. So when we send out the bill for comment, we send out resolution as part of that, and people get a full chance to comment on it, okay?
Yes.
And then I think what you must do is you must make a package for us on this issue and give us a memo explaining this issue you explained now, number one. Number two, all the different acts that are affected, the Seashore Act, this resolution, so on, all make a package for us so that when we discuss this matter, that it's available, everything, information is available to us and whoever is participating, okay? All right, so I think that's clear now to me. Let's move on. Anyone in the committee wants to say further clarity? Okay, move on, next clause.
That's still the 18 and 27 issue. That was the exclusion. The next issue, Chair, is the one of reclamation. For the benefit of people who are not familiar with the concept of reclamation, it's really filling in the sea, parts of the sea, to create land. So you can create islands and you can create platforms and you can build on those platforms and those islands, and that's what reclamation really means. So when you, for example, want to dig up and create a jet, you first have to reclaim and turn that sea into land. That's what reclamation is. In the existing act, it was just one line in section 27, and there was a need to look at this more carefully because, of course, reclamation is also a serious thing. It can range from small little projects like building slipways to actually massive infrastructure projects, infrastructurable, creating an island, and you'll see what the impact of that could potentially be if it's not regulated properly. There was therefore a need to create a comprehensive clause that deals with reclamation, which we've done, and when we go through the details, we can see whether there's anything else that we need to address there. We've just done this little bit of a diagram to give you somewhat of an illustration of what you're talking about. If you see that where houses are, this here is kind of this is your seashore, that's your beach. It goes down and then you've got the sea and there's a little island here. Now, I want you to pretend that that wasn't there before. If you look at the previous slide, you'll see there's nothing there. That's your seabed and this is your sea. That's Robert Island. Pardon me for the Cape Town example. It's the only one that's familiar to me because I live here. And it's the only reason I'm using this as an example. And Robert Island is a very good point of reference because it gives you a location.
I don't make excuses about Cape Town. Any problem with Cape Town run by the DA, but I don't have to address it.
Okay, so we've got the seabed over here. Now, if somebody wants to reclaim, what they'll have to do is they'll have to come to the to apply. They do an EIA, but the EIA scrutinizes certain things. It scrutinizes the environmental viability of that project. But if somebody wants to build an island, they're going to have to fill in that. Just looking at the environmental factors, you can build in mitigation, et cetera, and you can be okay. But that's not sufficient. That's why there's always been a process by which you must first apply for reclamation. And you've got it, and in this clause we look at concepts like what is the reason for the reclamation? Are you building this up so that you're going to create a whole series of islands so that you can walk to Robben Island eventually and change the face of Africa? We've had request to change the face of Abigail and our COO at the time, but adequately told him nobody wants to change the face of Africa. So if we have this kind of principle happening there, you need to scrutinize it. If somebody wants to do that, you need to find out why, and that's what this clause deals with. We can go into the details of it when we deal with it. I've projected some of the wording which we can go back to when we do the clause by clause as well. There's another issue that you'll see, Chair, that may cause some emotion or emotional reaction, and that is the issue of access to coastal public property. What this Act has done is it has made it unlawful to deny access to the beach. We have, and you need to know this background, because the amendments don't deal with this. The amendments deal with the fees, but it's linked, it's very closely linked. You've got a situation where these pictures that you see here are a legacy of apartheid. It is a community called Eastern Cape, not Western Cape. And there's a lovely little gated community that has almost private access to a very small stretch of beach. And apart from the principle that this is heinous to allow people to privatize beaches, there is a larger problem. There's a community that lives less than 20 kilometers away from this gated community who don't have access to a beach. And the reason for that is, if you look at the top picture on the left, you've got rocky cliffs and you've got inaccessible beaches due to the natural coastline. It's not like a normal beach where you can walk onto it. There's lots of cliffs and rocks and you can't get to it for about 80 kilometers before you get to another beach. So anybody else who wants to use a beach has to travel 80 kilometers, whether on foot, by bicycle or whatever, to get to a beach. And what the Act sought to address was that we shouldn't allow this to happen, that people should have free access to and along the beach. So you can't cut off a point along the beach when you're walking this way, or if you get from the land to the beach. This has created this kind of problem. We've had then engaged with discussions with that community, et cetera, to make sure that access is granted to the people who were previously excluded from it. That's an important principle that permeates a lot of sections in this Act. That's the gate. That when we were to do an in-local inspection, we were told we have to wait because there's no access, there's no remote to get to the gate. So we as department officials couldn't get to that beach to examine it to see what the extent of those access issues were. So nonetheless, eventually we got in and we stopped the process of dealing with that, and then members of the community were actually able to go to that beach. There are many other places like this. Of course, we've got our work cut out for us, and we're continuing to do that. But what you will see as an amendment in a bill is that in certain instances there's a legitimate charging of fees, and that you'll find mainly in harbors and ports and areas that are restricted. So we're saying that there are certain legitimate exceptions for charging fees to enter the coast, but we don't want these to be, and access to boat launching sites, etc. We don't want these be so high that it excludes certain members of the public, so that you make it only an elite thing that very wealthy people can access. And that's not the idea behind it. So what is in the Act at the moment is that anybody who wants to charge fees for access has to apply to the minister for permission to do so. Now, of course, implementing this has become extremely difficult because you just get a flood of applications and you need to come up with tariffs and you need to then decide how to do this, costing, etc. And to streamline that, there's a proposal that what can happen is that the minister can set a maximum fee by gazette in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And if anybody wants to charge in excess of that maximum, then must apply to the minister. We'll leave it to you to look at those clauses when we get to that, but that was the idea behind this. We bring access to your attention because it generally evokes high emotions from people. Chair, the other clauses, the National Coastal Committee, you will find also during the public comment process, there was a lot of reaction to the abolition of the National Coastal Committee. Now, on the face of it,
it looks like national government is trying to abdicate accountability. But that's not the idea behind this. One of the things that was discussed is we've got what is called, we have the existing intergovernmental fora, which is your MIC and MINTEC structures, in terms of which most of these things, through the cabinet process, are channeled. The idea is everything that would go to the National Coastal Committee will now go through these structures and still get scrutinized, and there'll still be space to call experts and to get that stakeholder engagement. But the reason why the National Coastal Committee was regarded as a less favorable option is because we've tried this before. If you recall CEC with NEMA, trying to get all the DGs together in yet another forum. It's just fallen away.
Yeah, but you know, I don't think the solution is going to work. I mean, to try and think that you're going to be able to pull together intergovernmentally that people act at one, as far as the coast is concerned, in MINMEC and MINTEC. Maybe this structure is not working.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because you put DGs on it. Maybe you shouldn't put DGs on it. Maybe you should put DGs on it. But it just seems to me, I mean, on the face of it, I don't think, I mean, I'm open to persuasion, but this just sounds wrong to me.
Chair, if we can just give you what the status quo is in fact, at MINTEC there was a separate working group, H created. All the provinces attend, and a large number of national governments also attend. So these are regular meetings that are already happening and already.
But that's between province and national. I mean, in East, the coast is got municipalities. What about municipalities?
They also attend, Chair. They got
MINTEC.
The MINTEC, the technical group, the working group.
See, in terms of the MINTEC and MINEX, what has changed the composition of the MINTEC and MINEX is that it also acts as delivery forum in terms of the outcomes approach. And because the delivery forums for the outcomes approach is linked to ministers' delivery agreement, we have both national and...
I see what you're doing. Parliament created a structure where it can have oversight of it. You're now moving this thing back into the executive. And you take, but MINTEC's on the executive, but nothing to do with us. There's no single MINTEC or no MINMEC that's ever, that we get reports in Parliament on. It's a structure that exists between you and other governments. The structure that has been created here, whether it works or not, is a structure that is created by Parliament, and it can then have a role. May not have done so, maybe because I didn't know it existed. Maybe. But what you're doing now is removing that structure and you're putting it back only in the executive. I mean, do you see what you guys are doing?
Well, I think we cannot understand it in terms of that implication, Chair, because practically how it was working, it was more in competition with the existing structures. Provinces did not actually even get to a point in the manner in which it is prescribed. Yes, the working group meets, and the coastal provinces meet with municipalities, and in all the municipalities right now, we do have the coastal committees, and at any point in time, there is that coordination. So both at the technical level, and at a political level, and I was also struggling to see why would Parliament not have an oversight in that committee, because it's still also an intergovernmental structure that is set up in terms of NEMA. So,
well, we don't have any authority over provinces, that's why. We can ask our minister about what she's doing and so, but we can't check on provinces. This structure that is created in legislation then creates an intergovernmental structure that we can then react to and interact to, because it's created by us and we can then do that. And if provinces and local government is there, then it doesn't matter because the structure is created in the legislation.
Okay.
But as soon as you remove it, you only put it in the MINTEC. I mean, the provinces go, no, we have no authority over provinces as a.
Okay.
We can invite them to come and give input, but I can't order necessarily, very easily. a provincial structure to govern.
Okay, well...
So I'm just saying,
this
is not the final word on it because the committee hasn't spoken.
Yeah.
I'm just a chair raising a problem that I think you guys have not looked at.
Okay.
Is that when you're creating intergovernmental structures that have to cut through national, provincial, it's very complex in South Africa. Very complex because there's original powers at different levels. So what we should look at rather is structures like this may be very, very necessary where you want to get your voices out. And maybe the way it's been set up and it's been structured is not the best way to do it. Maybe we should relook that. But I would want to have a full debate on whether this should just be abolished and then only to let it go back into MinMex. Because as I say, then I just think it just waters down Parliament's role and everything in the process. You see, when this structure exists, I can, for example, amend this Act now and say, I want this structure to report to Parliament twice a year. Now we have real power of oversight. But it may not be now that we're actually interacting with this structure, but if we amend it and say, you have to report twice a year, now there's a reporting obligation to this, and it will be this committee. And then we can start looking at things and see if you're doing all these things that should be done. I mean, the fact of the matter is those amendments that were made, I mean, I've been in this committee now here for 2 years as chair. I've never heard anything about coastal stuff. This is my first occasion that I hear about it. And I'm not blaming anyone for that. I'm just saying that's the fact of the matter. That's how things work. But if there was a different approach to this matter and this structure had to report Parliament once a year, twice a year, whatever it is, then it's a completely new picture. Because when we do our oversight hearings and so on, then we want to also hear from this trust, say, you know, what are they doing, whether we want it by you or via them and so on. So I think we must have a look at this thing. When you have a government function that runs through all three, we have to find innovative ways. And MinMex definitely are not innovative as far as Parliament is concerned. They're innovative as far as the executive is concerned. But at least they pull together the executive issues. But from our point of view, they don't help us with that. It may very well be that you guys later on make sure that the work gets done in a MinTech and so on, but of course that the authorities, this structure, you know, there are different ways of doing this. You don't have to repeat them. But let us have this full debate, unless anyone wants to answer questions or comment. But I think we'll have the debate at that stage. But I must just say, at the face of it, I'm prepared to hear you guys, but at the face of it, I think this is not a good solution. Or not a solution I think is going to be good for Parliament. All right, next one. No one? All right, next one. Is this what Parliament gave Fontenay?
Require what, and instead of a leader calling it a cultural discipline,
everyone to be able to regulate what you do there, because you can't just do this make a mess of me. So we want to promise that, and you must, as community users, you must use it in the way that we say so. So we put the conditions in the summit, and we say,
for a particular date, the 1st of January 2014 or whatever it is, and why we should hand over the power to the department to do so, okay? So I just want you to take that into consideration. All these transitional stuff, now we can look at that next day.
Okay.
All right, I think that was good. It gives me, in any case, a good feeling of what is coming. What I'll do now is Ms. Dawood will make sure that today I finalize the pitch statement and goes out and call for comments, and so that we have a public hearing a month or two down the line. So let's make sure that that happens. Anything else any member wants to raise about this bill? Okay, so it looks like there's a lot of good stuff here, this bill. And so we'll have some interesting. I just want you to give some thought to those other issues, the undoing of that resolution and the abolition of that committee, whether we don't need something actually that has a structure that has a mandate from Parliament, not a mandate necessarily from a department. Okay? To give some thought to that. And then, of course, all the work we asked you to do, the package of documents and so on, to sort that out. And when you're ready with it, then just give it all to Chileka, and we'll start circulating. Also, we need quite urgently the documentation, because obviously when we ask for comments, people ask documents, ask her. And I want her to give out this package of documents. If she gives the bill to people, I want her to give the documents as well, so that people know that that's what we're going to address. When they read the bill, they won't know that that's what we're going to address. For example, the resolution.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That is it. Remember, okay? You okay with that? Everyone happy?
Yes.
All right. Let's take a 5 minutes for people that want to go to dark, dingy places. Mark. Just make sure you take a dog with you. You don't get attacked there. We'll be back in 5 minutes, and then we'll do the last input on the green paper on oceans.
Okay. Yesterday,
also said, "Oh, it could be part of it." I told them yesterday to make it part of it.
Okay, thank you. It's
already. So hopefully, it'll just be one input on some things about the state of the ocean. Okay, have some tea outside. People have tea. Have some tea.